welcome back to Minority Reports Podcast. I'm your host, Mona Sheikh, and today we have a very special guest. I know that some of you might wonder, well, he doesn't really fit the minority perspective, given the name of my podcast is Minority Reports Podcast, but he is a minority in my eyes, mainly because he's a straight white male who is very liberal and has a point of view that supports minorities like myself. And to me, we have to give a shout out to our allies. So I'm going to welcome our very, very special guest. This guy really needs no introduction. He was on Whose Line Is It Anyway? He was a regular on Whose Line Is It Anyway? He was on one of my absolutely favorite shows, Third Rock from the Sun, and he's just done so many incredible things. I would like to welcome you, the very funny Greg Proops.
There we go.
There he is. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Having me on.
Thank you for joining me.
Of course.
This is so lovely. I love your jacket. Is that a leopard print? What are we looking at?
Right. It's leopard and tiger. If you notice, it kind of changes its stripes. It's from Elvis's tailor in Memphis. There's a place called Lansky's, and Lansky did all of his, the gold platinum jacket, and then that weird race car period he was in the 60s, where race cars were important. He did all those, and a lot of the rockabilly stars went to Lansky, and we stayed at this cute hotel in Memphis last year and had barbecue and went to Stax Records, which is incredible. Got to see Booker T's Oregon, the whole thing, and Isaac Hayes's Cadillac, which was anyway in the lobby of this hotel. There was a Lansky's, and I guess I went a little crazy, but I'm glad I did, because I wouldn't have it for the pandemic if I hadn't have sprung for it on the day.
I mean, it's what is that, like a $2,000 coat?
Oh, yeah. No, it was like $400, but I thought I was spending too much money on it. It is. Yeah.
It's pretty, nice.
It's loud, and it's hot to wear, but I don't care.
What is it? What's the material?
Oh my God. It's flammable. It's like, I don't know, but it's, hey, let me look. I can't see very well. I can't see it. It says, I think it says like, made by, oppressed people in a third world country, kind of.
Probably. Listen, one of my cousins probably made it for you. I don't know. All I know. Probably one of my cousins like did the stitching where the leopard and the tiger print meets. That's probably what they did. How are you holding up in the crazy world of the lockdown and the quarantine?
Day by day. Yesterday I did a stand-up show on Glebe's and Hofstetter's, Nowhere Comedy Club. And it was really cathartic for me. I was nervous all day, and I'm never nervous to perform. I've been performing since I was 400 years of this. And I'm gonna turn something off here that's driving me crazy. So it was good fun, and I had a couple buddies join me, Jill Margos and Joelle Johnson, who I was supposed to do gigs with both of them. Joelle I was supposed to do a theater with in March, and Jill I was supposed to do San Francisco with in July. So I asked them to come on this, you should do it if Ben, Ben, and he's
a nice guy. Nowhere Comedy Club?
Yeah. And people, you can see the audience, which I didn't do because it would make me too self-conscious, but you can see the audience, and you just do it like we're doing it right now, except you stand up. And I talked into a spoon. I talked into a spatula. I got drunk. I told stories. It was really, I needed it. You know what I mean? Because
Were you drunk before, or were you getting drunk during?
Both. Okay. I wasn't drunk before, but I did drink along with the crowd. I'm a traveling ham, as are we all. Our job is to tell jokes, perform, and act like a clown. And so I've been denied that, as have we all. And it's not the worst tragedy in the world. There's worse. But for us, we need to do it. So it was really important for me. And then I heard back from Jill and Joelle, and they said the same thing, that, they were not at top happiness yesterday. And getting to do what we do is therapeutic.
100%. Are you like, did you, when the lockdown started, like I was going through this, like just kind of bouts of kind of depression, with, like constant like anxiety, like what's going to happen? Like, what am I going to do? I had like 3 huge shows lined up this year. And that just went down the shitter. Like I couldn't do anything. This podcast that we do, Minority Reports, it's actually a live show that started off at the Comedy Store. And our show became the official show for LA Pride this year.
That's great.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was going to be this huge show where I was, I designed with the executive director of LA Pride, and then all went to shit. So I don't know. Have you been like experiencing that? I mean, you've been doing this, you know, way longer than I have, but did you kind of go through that? Like,
no question. Yeah. I've been, some days are really bad and you just feel like you can't move. You're inert. Yeah. It's also the frustration of not being able to not go outside and go to the beach. I'm not a moron. The people, to me, that is a white privilege writ large. To that you're inconvenienced for 2 seconds of your life.
Yeah.
And no understanding or awareness that in countries, say, for instance, Syria.
Yeah.
People have been locked down for 5 fucking years. They can't just go to the store every day. But white people never think about anyone but themselves. And that's why you see all these Nazis, and they are Nazis, with guns at the state house, spreading the disease and straining the healthcare system. So yeah, I get frustrated by that. Then I get filled with rage. Then I get filled with anxiousness and depression. Yeah. So I try to put the phone down.
Yeah.
And for a couple of hours a day, I am lucky enough to have a garage.
Yeah.
And I go into the garage and I smoke weed and I read detective stories and shit, or clean.
What do you smoke? What do you smoke? Sativa, indica?
I'm an indica girl. Right now we're on them. What do we got here?
Indica. Really? So you can smoke indica and stay up? If I smoke indica, I'm out. Oh, you smoke the flower. You don't do vaping. You don't vape.
No, I smoke. I'm old fashioned. I write with a pen. I wear a watch. Or I used to wear a watch before all this started. Now there's no point. And I roll my own.
Oh, look at that. Look at that. Right. I'm a big, I love to smoke. So I smoke every night. I'm a huge, my family gets a little offended when I talk about it.
Oh, really?
Only because, you know, I'm supposed to be a good Muslim girl. And not
right.
But I don't give a fuck. I like to smoke my weed, and that's what I like to do. And it's the month of Ramadan, so it's a holy month. So people are like, are you going to, like, give up weed? I'm like, I'm not giving up weed for Allah. I love Allah, but I'm not giving my weed up. Was it not the
cultures that follow Allah that gave us?
That is correct. Hashish. The best in the world, thank you. Like, we make the weed coming out of South America, a joke. Like in Afghanistan, is like in Pakistan, is some of the purest shit you'll ever smoke in your life. It's it's amazing. Have you ever had any hash from there? Ever?
I've had hash from Afghanistan.
Oh, you have.
We in the Bay Area in the 70s, it was pretty readily available. the 2 kinds you would get would be the crumbly Afghani kind that was that ochre color, and then the blonde Lebanese, and then there was the darker Moroccan brick type hash. That was like this is before it was legal, of course.
Sure.
I remember going to.
Where did you get it from? Like somebody would be growing it in their house and selling it illegally.
No, they'd have brought it over from the Middle East. It'd have been shipped over by drug dealers, is my guess. Yes, I was supporting an insupportable paradigm. What can I tell you? I remember I went to Marin once in college to do this interview for a guy who made tofu for a living, and he had a small tofu. This is so Bay Area. A tofu concern with these 2 women. And I was like, I can't remember. We were doing it for a class or something. And I was kind of directing this shoot. And we had a cameraman and whatnot. And I guess I was acting a little huffy because he goes, "Hey, man, you're acting a little uptight. Support the rebels in Afghanistan, right?" And he put the hash in my mouth. I thought. And of course, 20 minutes later, I'm like, this is the best show ever, man. Really, this tofu's amazing. You know, how to watch it go from soybean to the texture, you know. So that's why I remember that specifically, because there was a dazzling variety of weed and hash available when it was illegal.
Sure.
But it was different than now because it wasn't hydroponically cultivated the same way, you know.
That's right.
Weed from Mexico had bugs in it. You know, like you get the bag, there'd be a baggie, and at the bottom of it, there'd be a cricket or something, you know, and stems and whatever. And then the weed from South America tended to be more sticky and the weed from Northern California and Hawaii was way stickier, and they had the purple that came from, yeah, I don't know. This is this interesting to anyone, or have I lost everyone by being an ancient stoner?
I'm going to the dispensary and taking this for granted, and here I am talking to an OG. Like, I am really bad. Like, talk about weed privilege. Like, this is right? Weed privilage. I mean, and you're like, no, fuck that. I do old school. I don't understand. I've never even done hash from Afghanistan. I think the only reason I want to go to Pakistan is to do two things, to smoke the hash there and visit my dad's grave. That's it. Those are my two intentions.
Oh, yeah.
That's it.
I was in India a couple of years ago, but I was at a corporate gig, and there was no way that I was going to, as much as I wanted to, bring any or score any, because it would have been far too dangerous for me personally.
Sure.
And my wife.
What was that gig like for you?
What was what?
The corporate gig? What was
it? It was really wild. It was a crash course in another culture that I wasn't, these were tech people largely. Sure. And then regular people too. Whose line has been on Star TV in Asia for years.
Yeah.
So we're known in the subcontinent. We're known in the Middle East, Israel, whatnot.
Yes.
And so it was me and Jeff Davis, who I'm on tour with, or was on tour for the last 20 years. And we were in Bangalore and Hyderabad, and they're very tech places because it's the south of India. Way more Muslim and way more. They were a little more, I think a richer, the people of the South, in my understanding from the 2 weeks I spent, make fun of the people from the North.
That's
like the people from the North. They're the hillbillies, and we're the smart people with our big tech industry in there. The internet was so fast that the computer would rattle off the table to download something, it was astonishing. And then, of course, you go outside and there was a sea of people that I wasn't ready for. I've been to New York. I've been to Paris. Right. I've been to a lot of places, and I've never seen the sea of humanity.
Yeah.
And the abject lowest level poverty to the richest, all in one thing. It was a mind blowing.
Yeah.
And it was a little overwhelming. And so you had to kind of go back to the hotel every once in a while and decompress and understand that you can't help every individual case in a country with 1.6 billion people. It's a million Americas. Americans have no perspective at all. Pakistan and India and Bangladesh have as many people as the United States. No one even, thinks about that. India's 10 the United States.
That's right. Like 300 million in America? We're like 300 million, right? That's our population.
Yeah, 330.
Yeah. I just learned that LA is like 4 million people. I thought it was more than that.
Well, but the whole LA area is just gigantic. I mean, we're bigger than, like, for instance, part of white supremacy, now that you mention it, in the United States is that we let states like Idaho and Wyoming have a say in anything. They have 500,000 people. They're almost all white people.
Right.
And we here in LA are several countries worth of people.
That's bigger.
You could put Finland and Norway together with Sweden, and they don't have as many
Scandinavian countries because their populations are so small.
Yeah. And so the first thing I think you have to do is, the million things you have to do, but one thing that would help is to get rid of the Electoral College. But secondly, California and New York should have 10 senators.
That's right.
And those states have two. And that's how you redress this. Because someone like Mitch McConnell could never keep the hold that he has on if that wasn't in place.
That's right.
There's no reason that we shouldn't be represented, and we aren't represented. California absolutely doesn't get the representation nationwide. So I think that would be one way to do it, is to make it a population thing.
100%. I mean, but I think the Republicans come out and argue, well, if you're a small state, Vermont or, Rhode Island, is it fair because you're a smaller, you have smaller population and that you shouldn't get the same size, you shouldn't get the same equal representation as bigger states like Californians, so they come out and make that argument.
Well, the argument's always made from states that are, almost completely homogeneous and white.
Yes.
The percentage of Black people in Vermont and New Hampshire is extraordinarily small. I love playing there. They're good people, you know. It's like going to like a Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And they're really nice. They're smart.
You mean spending your whole paycheck? Is that why it's like?
Right. It's like, yeah, spending, having to take out a loan to buy a jar of a tahini.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the only people who ever make that argument are conservative white people. And I'm tired of it. It's boring.
Yeah.
They will do anything to keep women and people of color from voting, or the disabled, or whatever group you want to think of, LGBTQ what? People. It is only in their interest to keep everyone from having a voice, which is why, as you said at the beginning, I'm a cis white guy, even though I make no case for it, clearly, not with this backdrop. And I can't.
What you're talking about. We need more cis men like you, so I don't know what you're talking
right?
about.
Right? I can't do anything with the small platform I have, but try to amplify women and people who can't speak out's voices. What else would I do with it? I don't even understand white guys' mentality, that insular, everything revolves around me and my sexual needs. And if there's any hindrance to that at all, I'm going to scream and shout and yell about freedom and stupid shit that white men have no right to yell about. White men have all the fucking rights. And when I ever hear a white guy go, like, I need freedom.
Straight white men, yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They go, I need my freedom. I got to do it. And I don't know why I do a country voice. It's not just people in the country, you know. It's the slick back Harvard think tank.
Yes.
White guy, you know. It's easy to make fun of hillbillies.
Yes.
But the thing about that is my mother was from Mississippi and was part of a sharecropper family with a million kids. And there's plenty of nice, poor white people all over that aren't insane, gun-toting maniacs. And I think your West Coast liberals, myself included, it's very easy to make fun of that because people will say stupid things like, well, Mississippi doesn't even matter. Or, you know, Alabama doesn't even matter, like in the national arena of politics. Right. And you'll find that Black people so often are right about who to vote for because, well, I don't know why I'm telling you this, Moni. You know it as well as anyone. When you're not a white person,
yeah,
you have to use all of your resources simply to survive politically day to day and not get shut out. So, right, of course, they're going to know who to vote for. People of color always know who to vote for because they have to vote to literally protect their lives.
Right.
And white people don't understand that at all. White people are like, well, I like this candidate because he yells a lot or whatever. You know?
He speaks the truth. Well, you don't know. I don't know if that's necessarily the right person.
Right.
You want someone who's tactful. I mean, tact is really, that plays a huge role in politics. Yeah. You know, you were talking about Kentucky. So you were talking about Mississippi. My family, the reason we came to the United States is because I have four older brothers, and my two brothers, my second and my third brother, were given expired vaccination for polio, and they got polio because of it.
Impacted. Oh, no.
Yeah. And there was no treatment for it at the time. And my mom would write letters to hospitals around the world saying, I have two sick children who need help because there's no treatment for them. And Shriners Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, wrote my mom back and said, you know, if you just fly yourself out with your kids, we'll pay for everything.
Really?
And that's how we ended up in America.
That's fantastic.
I have so much love for Shriners Hospital and what they did for my family. But mm-hmm. My mom, like, it's interesting because of what's happening right now and the juxtaposition to the America she describes to me, the Kentucky she describes to me from the 1980s and the 1990s. You know, she first of all, she calls them pure white people because my mom thinks like America only belongs to white people. So that's number one. So even when I say I'm an American, she's like, yeah, but are you though? And, you know, there's always like this doubt because in her mind, how she sees America is a white country. Like that's what it is. But she always tells me like the sweetest stories about how the Kentuckians treated her with like so much love and so much respect. And there was never any disrespect because she was Muslim. She was like, you know, I'd be praying and these huge surgeons would literally just wait at the door for me until I finished my prayers. Like, mm-hmm. She has like such a great experiences that she had in Kentucky. So now when I hear about, you know, people, you know, whether it be in South and Midwest, you know, talking about they want immigrants and this and that. So my mom is like, I don't understand that. I don't get it because I didn't come to that. That's not the America I know. The America mm-hmm. I know embraced me with both arms and my children and, you know, helped give us like this incredible life. So you were talking about your mom's from Mississippi. What about your dad? Like, where was your dad from?
He was from Brooklyn. And you reminded me of something that happened to me years ago. I was at a taping of Dennis Miller's old HBO show. And I was with a comedian friend of mine named Warren Thomas, who's passed away. But he was black. And Dennis did this joke about everybody should speak English or something. And it was kind of, you know, one of his sort of rednecky. This was before he'd gone full insanity.
Yeah.
After Bush and all that.
Yeah. Thank you for pointing that out, by the way.
So. Right. Yeah. And he made this joke. And I turned to Warren and I said, everyone in your family speak English when they came over here? Mm. You know, I mean, it is the stupidest. My father's family spoke German and Yiddish. Wow. And so they so did not speak English. And then they had to after a while, you know, by my dad's generation or my grandfather's. Yeah. But my great-grandparents, they were Germans.
That's right.
They were German Jews. So, and German Jews, you know, as you know, got a kind of a rough deal in the last century.
Yes, they did. Hunters on Amazon. Have you seen the show yet?
Have I seen what?
Hunters. It's about Nazi hunters.
Oh, really?
It is amazing.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I'm like, I'm all for Nazi hunting. Let's watch the show. Like,
oh, bring it back. You know, there's plenty of them out there now. I can find a few for you in the Senate.
Right? Oh my God. Why do they call them neo-Nazi? It's not like they like rebranded themselves, but they're just like, well, now we only hate a specific kind of people. Like,
right.
You know, like, why is it neo-Nazi? Like, you're a fucking Nazi, period. Like, you're not. Why is it neo-Nazi?
Oh, because white men run the media. And those kind of labels are so easy for white people to digest. A neo-Nazi, oh, you know, your swastika only has, you know, 3 points on it, not all, you know, 4. It makes them feel good, I think. When you see, like, these people who are protesting around the country that are being paid and funded by the DeVos family and the Spencers and whatnot, and they often have Confederate flags or Nazi flags with them. And I saw a sign today that said, Arbeit macht frei, which is German for work means freedom. And that was the sign that was posted over all the concentration camps at the gate.
Whoa.
So that when the Jews and the gypsies and the homosexuals and the intellectuals were let in and the communists were taken to the camps, the sign that they saw was basically a promise, work makes you'll be free if you work hard enough, which of course they weren't, they were exterminated. And okay. When you say neo-Nazi, it drives me crazy. They're Nazis. If you have a Confederate flag and you believe in what the Confederacy believed in, then you believe that certain people are subhuman and you are not.
That's right. You know, the interesting thing about Trump to me is that, you know, when Trump got elected and even when he was running, I grew up under a dictatorship in Pakistan.
Right.
So, and I moved when I was a teenager at 15. So I remember everything about what it was like growing up under a dictatorship. I mean, you know, we had tanks, we had, you know, curfews, we had martial law, 8 p.m., you can't leave home. There's a tank waiting outside your building. If you leave, they arrest you. They have like these, you know, it's entirely militarized. And, you know, you're just constantly living in terror. You don't want to do anything wrong. They can, you know, the military can show up to your business like they would to my dad's. And then my dad had a big car business and they would just show up to his showrooms and be like, we'll take this car and that car and that, mm-hmm. that car. You have no say, by the way. If you stand up, they dragged my dad to the jail. They beat the shit out of my dad because my dad stood up to them. They busted my dad's head open. I remember all of that. I remember my dad coming home. It was the middle of Ramadan, his shirt was covered in blood because he stood up. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I grew up with. So when I see somebody like Trump and how he's trying to get rid of the middle class, which is what they did in Pakistan and which what they continue to do in Middle East and even in South Asia, and to get rid of checks and balances. I mean, checks and balances is what keeps the dictators away. You know, that's what brings these assholes in power. I mean, do you think, like, let's say we have, you know, we have our elections in November 2020 and Trump loses. Do you think, like, are we looking at some kind of a civil war with these fucking Nazis? Like, what are we looking at?
I know. That's what I keep worrying about. And part of why I think we're all so anxious. I think the election will happen. And it is my fervent wish, and I believe if people are allowed to vote, that he will lose. He lost the last time. It was rigged, as you know. Yeah, I think the likelihood of these weird militia groups trying to threaten people and ride around cowboy style in cars and stuff is real. And I think that at that point, then we're in a very bad situation. I'd like to think that there'll be a smooth transition of power, but he gives no indication whatsoever that he respects anything even remotely like a smooth transition. What I think people shouldn't freak out about is if we're going to have an election, we're going to have an election. He can't call it off or
That's
whatever.
Right. Right.
And that I think is a certainty. Whether we vote by drive-through or by mail or absentee or whatever it is we have to do is another matter entirely. I'd like to think that that if something awful like armed insurrection happens, that really it's small and not. I mean. Like, for instance, the Women's March, the first one, was the biggest demonstration of people on the streets in the history of the United States. Yeah. These ones that we're seeing here and there with the paramilitary dudes, paramilitary, with the neo-Nazis, are small. There are hundreds of people. So to me, that's not like a giant majority movement. Most people really do want to stay at home and keep safe and get through this.
Yeah.
These are assholes fomenting insurrection, chaos, and destruction. And I think they'll be the instrument of their own demise.
Yeah.
Gathering in groups like that's highly unhealthy in this day and age, quite frankly. Right. And it's a little Darwinian here, if you get what I'm... I don't wish it on anyone, but it's
yes.
If you're that stupid, you know, eventually the herd gets thinned.
I mean, but they also always drink the Clorox or the disinfectant or have UV lamps shoved up their ass. So that's... Mm-hmm. You know,
also, I think it's important for us. You've had so much hardship in your life and your family's endured so much. I think a lot of white people have to get the news that we don't need to be afraid of these Nazis with guns.
That's
because
right.
They don't have power over us. We outnumber them for one thing.
Okay.
And two, they're not like they're not millions of people.
That's right.
It's a small group that's trying to scare everyone by walking around with weapons. And mm-hmm. You see what a lot of them look like. They're not scientists, you know?
Right. Not the healthiest either, by the way. Not like the most shaped people, in shape people either.
I mean, no, notice that. It's pretty wild, right?
Broken grease is just not working out for them. No.
I think that, you know, there's been hate groups in America since America started. America is a hate group. I mean, you know, like the reason why we have a prison system is because of slave patrols. You know, if you can't control people one way, you have to control them another way. Okay. And this is just another tool, I think, in the white supremacists who run the country, another tool for them to sow chaos. And the thing that I like people to think about is, when you see these white guys with guns, and I'll often say on Twitter or something that they're white supremacists, and white people and robots will contest me all day long. How can you say they're white supremacists? Okay. Because a white man with a gun in a public place is controlling the situation. And that means anyone who's not a white man, anyone who's a woman, children, people of color, that's who they're intimidating.
Yeah.
It's that simple. The Second Amendment is a white supremacist amendment. Guns are part of the hegemony. It's a proven statistic. I'm not making any of this up. Most gun owners are white guys. It's that simple.
Right.
And if you saw 1,000 Pakistani immigrants standing on the steps of the state house in Michigan, how long you think that would last before they tear gassed everyone to death?
But exactly. You know, I actually was making this joke that, you know, they don't want to pass responsible gun laws. So I think what the Muslims in this country should do is to just, they should just all go out there and just buy guns. Watch the laws change so fast.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. I always say that. I say in my comedy jokes, I can get you gun control tomorrow. Every woman here, go to the gun shop tomorrow morning and say, I need 5 AR-15s and 25,000 rounds of ammunition.
Yep.
When the guy says, why, I go, I'm just not feeling it, man.
That's right.
And I said, at 10:05, they will call the Senate into order.
Yes, they will. There will be a congressional hearing like that.
It happened in California when I was a kid. The Black Panthers were very, very tired of being shot in their own neighborhoods. Mm. And they organized and they went to Sacramento. And you can look this up. It's like 69. And they all had weapons with them. Unlike this gravity ass rabble that's doing it now, they were organized because they were a community organization. They had a hierarchy, they had rules. So they showed up in their Panther outfits with their guns and went right into the Capitol, where the Senate meets, where the state assembly meets. And boy, did gun laws get passed the week after that. And I mean, like, as soon as they saw, look up the Black Panthers storming the Capitol.
I'm fascinated by this.
It happened in California. The reason why we don't have open carry in this state is that because Black people decided to walk down the street with their firearms like this and go, it's our right.
Yeah.
It's our right too. And as soon as Black people did it, California stopped doing it because they marched right into the Capitol, scared the devil out of everyone by being Black, as my friend Warren used to say, by being Black on a sunny day. You know, you don't have to commit a crime. You know what I mean? If you're not a white person, you're in danger from the police.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, my family lives in Texas and they're open carry state. My brother and I, my brother took me to Cheesecake Factory. I don't know why. It's not that my father knew that. And then we went to Cheesecake Factory and there's a guy sitting there with literally an AR-15 on his shoulder.
Right.
And I was like, dude, do you need an AR-15 at the Cheesecake Factory?
Yep.
Why do you need that? Like, what is that about? It's about showing power and intimidation. Like, mm-hmm. that's all it's about. It's like, there's nothing else to it. I mean, why else would you need an AR-15? I don't understand. Like,
it's simply not. I think it's a real power thing.
They're going to lose their country, Greg? Is that what's happening? They think they're going to lose their country to immigrants and people of color. Is that what the fear is?
Yes. The lack of power that they perceive on their own part. And James Baldwin said something that is, I think, always been true. And he, you know, was a Black artist who had to deal with, and a gay Black artist who had to deal with tons of issues. He spoke eloquently about civil rights his whole life. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you saw when Beale Street was, what was the name of that? Jennifer, what?
If Beale Street could talk.
James Baldwin wrote a book that was made into a beautiful movie. And now I've just blanked on his name. Barry Jenkins. Thank you. Barry Jenkins, the director who did Moonlight, did a movie a year ago called If Beale Street Could Talk, and it's a James Baldwin book. I'm going to circle back to my quote here. Uh-huh. The plot of the movie is a Black man is falsely accused of a crime, and he has to go through the justice system and what it's like to try for his family to sort that out, the giant Leviathan bullshit that is being a Black person sent through. The false accusations, the lies, the lie. And James Baldwin said, one of the reasons I think people cling to their hate is that if they didn't, they would have to deal with their pain.
Mm.
And I think that these gun owners, the white supremacists, the Trumpkins, they like the screaming, they like the racism. That's why they're there. It's not a philosophical thing and it's not economic anxiety. The screaming and the racism give them a chance to mask the horror and the terror of looking at themselves and seeing, as you point out, many of them are obese. Many of them have health problems. Many of them are poor.
That's right.
And they're voting against their own interests, but they don't care. So what would compel you to vote against yourself and keep electing people who are clearly white supremacists? And don't come at me with all white people, that you're not all white people, because what was it? 56% of white men and 53% of white women voted for Trump.
That's right. They did.
So it's that fucking simple. Yeah. Don't come at me with the, well, some white people are nice. Hooray. Some murderers are nice too and have a dog. I think that facing how mediocre you are, facing the fact that you're lazy and that television and fast food and bad education have combined to create this perfect storm of people who are susceptible to Russian disinformation, they'll see something on their phone and believe it. They don't fact check it. They don't think about it. So when someone comes along like Trump and says, I'm going to stop these black, you know, there'll no more immigrants and that'll solve it. And of course, look where we are. You let someone like that in 3 years later, we're in the middle of a pandemic with a psychopath who has no plan for us because he's a traitor. So that's my take on it. I don't know if I'm right. I do know this, that I've been politically motivated my whole life, but this has turned me into a zealot. You know, I was a zealot before. I did as much as I could within the confines of my fucking whatever comedy career to still support abortion and people call it the satna. But now I'm going to live through this, Mona. And when we get out the other side of this, so that I can personally spend every moment of my life trying to destroy the Republican Party and pick it apart and have it shown for what it is.
Yeah. I mean,
they're not, oh, there's good Republicans and blah, blah, blah. If you subscribe to it, if you support him, that's it.
That's right.
This is white supremacy. This is chaos and madness. This is anti-science, anti-women. If it wasn't the babies in cages, that was enough for you. If it wasn't watching Puerto Ricans die, that wasn't enough for you. If it wasn't seeing everyone's rights stripped away from them and the court stacked with Nazis, that's right. I don't know what's going to get through to you, but it won't get through to a lot of people. But I don't have that much longer, you know, 10, 15 years and 20 years. I'm going to spend that time doing nothing.
You don't know that. You could be up to live up to 100, Greg.
Okay, well, if I have 40 more years, I'm going to spend every goddamn day.
Wearing that fabulous jacket of yours.
Wearing this fabulous jacket and smashing Nazis in the head because I don't want to hear about it anymore. And I don't want to hear about both sides, and I don't want to hear about, you know, the rationales that the media will throw at you and that white people will throw at you constantly. If you're not lifting up the poorest members of society, then you're not doing shit.
I 100% agree with you. You know what? It's so interesting, you know, like the way you speak so eloquently and so passionately about, you know, from the cis male gender point of view about standing up to these Nazis is the point of view that I stand up to about the level of like misogyny and gender inequality and, you know, the ISIS and the Taliban and these, you know, crazy, you know, Muslim terrorists who go around basically making Muslims like myself and so many others look like assholes. And I feel like what's happening, and I think I get in trouble for saying this sometimes among mostly my own people, is that there, you know, in our culture, especially I'm talking about like the Muslim culture, I feel like we're very quick to, it's okay to criticize Trump and, you know, the Nazis and rightfully so because they're assholes and they deserve to be criticized. But I feel like whenever it comes to the criticism of what's happening in our culture, as far as like, you know, the gender inequality for women, the misogyny, the double standard that happens, you know, the kind of mentality of not wanting to separate church and state, which is a huge problem in pretty much all Muslim countries, you know, I get in a lot of trouble for it the moment I get up and I start criticizing, or you heard some of the jokes that I make about virgins and all that. I get in a lot of trouble for it. Do you feel like American society, and I'm going to talk about, you know, white people in general. Do you feel like, do white Americans get nervous or get scared a little bit when it comes to possibly even, you know, citing or even slightly criticizing like the fucked up parts of another culture like the Muslim culture? Do you think like there's like this kind of unspoken fear that runs, that's an undercurrent in things?
I think there is. I think Islamophobia is the new, you know, what replaced hating Jews in the, you know, by the Nazis. This administration has firmly and, I know, vividly, by banning a bunch of countries from even having people come here, strictly because they're Muslim. And including recently, what was it? Nigeria, which has one of our giant trading partners. I mean, that's just pure racism. Americans really love to criticize Muslim groups. And when Muslim terrorists act out, it's always, oh, how were they weaponized? How were they brought into this, you know, terrible culture? When they never want to look at all the Nazi groups, then white supremacist groups around the country that are dangerous as well. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right about Islam. One of the main, you know, in order for society to move forward, you have to elevate women. And the Islamic countries are not getting that done, you know, not to the degree where I've been to Saudi, I've been to Turkey, I've been to Dubai, and India, where I was in India. It was just, it's extraordinary, the misogyny and the violence that goes on toward women in those places.
Yep.
And that's the first thing you have to do is lift up women. One thing that I always like to say, which I don't think a lot of people think about, or men, is there's no such thing as like women's issues. All issues are women's issues.
Right.
Because gun control is a women's issue, because women are the ones who get killed. Mm-hmm. Healthcare is a women's issue, because women are denied healthcare. Gender equality is the biggest issue of all.
Sure.
If you make women equal and pay them equally, then that eradicates almost all. And now we're seeing with all the healthcare workers, all the frontline people are women and women of color.
That's right.
And we depend on them for literally everything, to raise our children, to take care of the elderly. So I don't know, that was a rambling answer. The other thing is, you know, years ago I was in the Gulf with Drew and we were doing a USO tour. Yeah. This is after we were bombing Afghanistan. And a lot of people said to me, why did you go? Isn't that supporting the war machine? And I'm like, well, we were entertaining soldiers, many of whom are people of color. The military is built on that. It's women. There's plenty of gay people in the military, too, I can assure you. And even when they weren't allowed to be in it, they were there. And serving the country.
Some of the don't ask, don't tell policy, that crap.
Yeah. So I was in a car with two airmen who were women. And they were driving us to this really bizarre, gigantic tech outpost where the war was being conducted in remote from Riyadh. This is before we moved our headquarters to Qatar, or as we insist on calling it, Qatar. this was outside of Riyadh, and we drove on a road that was being swept of sand with brooms by Pakistanis, third country nationals that the Saudis bring in, take away their passport and make them indentured slaves for 5 years or whatever it is.
That's right.
And that's who works on our bases. And the company that ran the culinary and washing and, you know, the care of the base was Halliburton through a subsidiary called Brown and Root. Dick Cheney, of course, was the CEO of Halliburton. Mm-hmm. The war in Afghanistan and Iraq were catered by Halliburton. So I'm with these two troops, and they were lovely young women. They were in their 20s, and they were from Ohio, I think. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, can I ask you guys something? And they're like, what? And I go, do you know what Islam is? Mm-hmm. The what Islam is? And they went, no. I go, do you know who the Prophet Muhammad is? And they go, no. I go, are you aware that this country is where Islam originated in the Middle Ages, and that the Prophet was born here and died here, and that Riyadh, the town we're quite close to, and Mecca and Jeddah and whatnot. And they were like, no, we don't know anything about it. I go, do you speak any Arabic? They go, no. No. So these troops were at this airbase, and that's how much orientation they had. It wasn't their fault.
That's right. That's right.
And they were in the military. They were a non-commissioned, you know, they were corporals, and they literally didn't know jack fuck all.
I mean, they're not going to, right? I feel like, you know, the whole objective about being a soldier and keeping soldiers in check and in line and to, you know, march to orders is like to not give them that knowledge, to not arm them with that, because that's how you keep them in check. If you give them all that knowledge, then they start thinking for themselves, and that's a no-no. Like, you don't. That's not how you control people. You control people by withholding information and not letting them know and say, hey, you're going there to serve your country, you know? And then they're like, but well, I don't understand. These people haven't done anything bad to me. But no, you're serving your country. So you don't ask any questions, you know? Which is very interesting, which is the same thing. So how we use that in military, that's the same mentality used in Muslim countries by using religion, by saying, you know, it's the word of the Quran, it's the word of Allah, and you don't question it, and then that's that. And by the way, the objective is exactly the same. It's control.
Yep.
Right?
Well, you want blind devotion, because blind devotion creates, you know, zealots, and you can tell a zealot what to do.
That's right.
Oh, go do that. Go condone that. Go make that act of violence or whatever. And they don't go, you know, I really oughtn't do that. It's not a very wise thing to do.
That's right.
There's no consideration. And well, after they took us to this place, on one wall, you may find this interesting. This was 2001.
Wow.
One wall was a map of Afghanistan, yeah. And one wall was a map of Iraq. We were not at war with Iraq. This was 2001. The war didn't start until 2003.
Mm-hmm.
We were already bombing the devil out of the Afghans. And this air base had more hardware and software than you could possibly imagine. We were a load of comics, right? We were like the Who's Line guys with Drew Carey and whatnot. Right. They let us into a room that they wouldn't have let Senator Hillary Clinton into, I swear to you. It was so high clearance.
Whoa.
But because we were comedians, they like flipped over a couple code books, turned off a couple screens and let us into this little tiny room, the Sanctum Sanctorum, as the Romans said, the nerve center. Two wars, right? One that we had not declared, one that we had started,
right?
Which is still going, by the way,
that's
18
right.
years later. That's and right. There were sorties on these maps, on these giant computer maps, B-1s and B-2 bombers, flying missions where they were dropping payloads on civilians. And the Iraq map also had jets on it. So there was a colonel in this room, and they were busy schmoozing with Drew and everything. And I said to him, may I ask a question about that map over there, Iraq? I go, we're currently pursuing a no-fly zone, is it, with them? I said, so say, for instance, a Soviet MiG that they bought flies into the airspace, what do we do? And the colonel was a lantern-jawed, you know, typical Dr. Strangelove, you know,
sure. Officer,
went, we deter them. And I said, Colonel, would you care to expound on the definition of deter? And he went, suffice to say, we deter them. So to the best of my knowledge, what I can infer, is that the word or is it imply? What I can infer from our conversation some 18 years ago was that we were already pursuing an air war in Iraq way before Tony Blair demanded we join and W demanded we join and Cheney demanded we join and Dick Rumsfeld and Don Rumsfeld, I mean, and Colin Powell quit halfway through the gig because
right.
Yeah, obviously he was disgusted.
That's
with
right.
What the fuck we were doing.
That's right.
And this current paradigm that we're enjoying now, this chaos, is a direct result of all of that. Nothing happens for no reason. The Arab Spring happened and then was immediately shut down. And then the chaos of Syria on top of it all, that enfilade of human misery streaming into Europe that the Europeans refused to fucking deal with.
That's right.
And
well, Germany stepped up to the plate, and I have a lot of
Germany respect. Did, but Germany's an organized country with an enlightened leader like yes. Angela Merkel is, you know.
She's a scientist. She's a scientist. Yeah. She's amazing.
I don't know. I'm sorry. That was a long, boring story, but I remember everything that happened when I was there because
yeah.
I felt like I was having a hallucination the whole time.
Yeah.
We were doing two things at once. We went to an airbase in Oman, and the colonel came on the bus of all the comedians and told us as we were driving in, this place doesn't exist. That's how high level it was.
Wow.
He went, we're going here.
Yes.
It doesn't exist. That's and I was like, okay, so I'm going to an imaginary place where I'm going to eat, perform.
Yeah. That's right. That's exactly where you're going. You're to an imaginary place. You know, that's so funny you said that. So in 2005, my father passed away and I went to Pakistan. And by the way, I could not attend his funeral. And I could not see him dying while he was dying in the I could not see him while he was dying in the hospital because my my citizenship paperwork was stuck because of September 11th, and they refused to process my paperwork. So I kept calling the immigration. My lawyer kept calling them and saying, like, look, her father is dying. He's not going to be alive for too long. Like, let her go. Let her, like, and they were like, if you leave the country, you're not allowed to come back for 10 years. So you take your pick. So my father passed away. I never got to say goodbye to him. I never attended his funeral. So like those are just scars that like never leave you, right? They're just like such a huge part of your existence. Finally, when I did go to Pakistan to go to my dad's funeral, I would go about like I grew up in Karachi, which is a southern city in Pakistan. And whenever I would like go around like signals and like big, like where they had big billboards, they would literally have these huge billboards of like Condoleezza Rice, Bush, like with fangs and like blood dripping down. Mm-hmm. I would say in Urdu, which is a native tongue, yeah. These are the vampires that are out here sucking the blood of innocent people. And I had never seen something like that before in Pakistan, like that before. I had just never seen it. And
this is when Mubarak was. This is when Mubarak was leader.
Musharraf. Musharraf, yeah. Musharraf was in power. And it's interesting, when Musharraf was in power, you know, people became millionaires overnight at the Karachi Stock Exchange because they made so much money because U.S. had lifted all these sanctions, all the money was pouring in, and like the infrastructure was thriving, and it was really doing really good. And then, of course, Musharraf didn't deliver on his promise of delivering Osama bin Laden, and then he was dethroned, of course, as the story goes. But I actually want to ask you, I know you previously quoted about James Baldwin and you talk about pain, and I just brought up this whole thing about my dad. How much how much do you think has pain played a role for you in becoming what you have become, as you know, you becoming a comedian and an artist? Like has pain played a role in it, and does it continue to play a role in it?
I think it does. It's not the end all and be all of the source of creativity. I used to think that, you know, you had to be a little tortured to even bother. But I think that ever since 45's come in, I've been triggered way more by that than I had before. I hated W and Cheney, and I still do, and I don't ever forgive them. But W and Cheney didn't remind me of anyone personally. My father was a big bellicose New Yorker. Okay. And he hated women, and he was fairly racist, and 45 couldn't remind me of him more. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm completely split open by how triggered I am by him. Mm-hmm. Him when he tells women to shut up, mm-hmm. when he says black women are stupid, mm-hmm. all the things that he does. The difference was my father, horribly, was very intelligent. He had a lot of emotional difficulties. So that pain is always sticks in my ass because to see the misogyny and the racism and the screaming.
Yeah.
Because my dad was screamy.
Right.
And
you have to assert that power, right? You have to let
That drives me mad. And so, to answer your question, that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
That kind of pain drives me mad because I saw what it did to the women in my family.
Yeah.
You know, and me.
Yeah. Did your parents divorce or did they?
Oh, no. They stayed together to the bitter goddamn end. Horrible. I begged them to divorce each other.
Pakistani style marriage right there.
No kidding, man.
Are you sure your parents aren't Pakistani? My goodness.
Right?
Oh, my God, Greg. That's incredible.
Oh, wow. You know, if there's one thing that connects all of us, it's that, you know?
That's right.
Kind of thing is that I am so tired of hearing about how different people are and stuff when the truth is, give me a break. I mean, and I'm so glad that in the last, I travel all the time, or used to, but in the last couple of years, my wife and I got to go to India and Japan, and I've never been to either place, and I was riveted, you know. And at the end of the day, it's the people you take away, the food, the beauty, the how nice people are.
Yeah,
it's not at all. I have friends who really just literally couldn't go. You know what I mean? They couldn't go.
Yeah,
they would just, you know. Yeah. They'd lose their shit.
Yeah.
And we perform for crowd, and then you get a real dose of what the world is like. Mm. Crew guys, barefoot crew, sleeping under the stage during the show. I asked the stage, the guy who was, you know, producing it, the tech producer, I go, this is a three-person show. It was an Indian comedian named CJ Papa who lived in Delhi.
Yeah.
And then me and my buddy Jeff, we did a little improv. How many people on the crew? And he goes, oh, you know, 85. And they would build the stage, build the whole thing, and put in all the seats, and then strike it after. There was no built stage. You know what I mean? No set stage at the venues we played.
Right.
And in the front, bottle service, table service, vodka, whiskey, in India, in the Muslim part of India. Yeah. Whiskey and vodka, buckets of ice, rich people sitting down front. And then literally behind a barrier, the poor people sitting for 20 rupees in the back. And so I would go into the audience and talk some to rich people sometimes, many of whom also lived in Sunnyvale or, you know, the tech area. There are a lot of tech people.
Sure, sure, sure.
The Rajas, as you would say.
That's
here,
right.
They're the Chads, but they're the tech Raj.
Rajas.
And then I would go to the back and to get, you know, with my mic and go, because the tech was great, to talk to them back there to get suggestions. And yeah. I go, Jeff, you don't mind, I'm going to go to the poor people section for a while and talk to some of them. And of course, everybody'd laugh.
Sure.
And then the other part that's hilarious is because, it wasn't hilarious, but I mean, the realization that it's a full employment economy, 80 people on the crew, many of whom didn't have shoes or anything. I went to the bathroom earlier in the day in the venue, and there was nothing, no water, no towels, no soap. And I'm like, why is that? And then of course it dawns on me. There's a woman who comes at 4 o'clock. Her job is to bring the soap and the towels. And that's her job. Her life is this bathroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And then the people in the kitchen, they had a full kitchen, you know, with fried fish and the whole, we were, you know, you're from, our bodies can't tolerate the things that are in their food unless it's well cooked, right? So that was the main concern, was don't get violent.
I get sick. I have to be very careful.
Right? I've heard that from Indian friends who go back to the subcontinent and then stay at their mom's house, and then they get sick after a week because. So before the show, we had our own little dressing rooms, which were cute, and a bottle of vodka, whatnot. It was Puff Daddy's. It was that brand of vodka. It's called C-Rock or something.
Oh God,
this is awful. And anyways, a refrigerator in my dressing room, not plugged in, a 50s one, not plugged in. You open it, it was hotter in the fridge than it was in the room.
Jeez.
And it was hot. And in it, two gas station, you know, the cardboard sandwiches that you get from the gas station that are in a cardboard thing, of tuna salad and egg salad. So I take them out of the refrigerator, and the Indian comic comes running into my dressing room, and he goes, do not fucking eat those sandwiches.
Yeah,
he goes, you will die if you eat that sandwich. And then he told us he'd had dengue fever the year before that he got, right?
Yeah.
So one of the gigs we played was in this beautiful venue next to a lake, and it had little bungalows and more mosquitoes than I've ever seen in my life inside the bungalows that was our dressing rooms. And we were on a lake, so Jeff kept calling it Lake Zika. We frantically called the promoters to our dressing rooms, have them smoke so that they could dissipate the cloud of mosquitoes somewhat. Mm-hmm. And we had to spray ourselves all over our suits and our dress clothes, mm-hmm. Thinking, oh God, there's Zika, there's dengue fever. We had to take a malaria pill, so we'd all take on a steady diet of malaria pills before you go, you know, and you carry on taking them when you come back.
Did you get shots of some kind?
Every diphtheria, tetanus, everything, because it's a real issue.
Yeah, and you didn't get sick, though.
I didn't. Jeff got kind of ill from the malaria pills on the way over, but I gave him some hard drugs, and he went right to sleep. But what was frustrating was, you know, you take a walk and there'd be a fruit stand.
Yeah.
And they're selling delicious fruit drinks.
Oh.
Everywhere. To get Americans to understand, it's not the fruit and it's not the people or the sanitation. They wash the knife.
Yes.
And the water that they wash the knife in has the microbes that kill you.
That's correct.
So when they slice the fruit, it's that simple. And it's like, So we just stayed to cook food. The hotels we were at had gorgeous Indian food.
I mean, you have to. You're going to be in a lot of trouble if you don't. I mean, I haven't been to Pakistan since, 2006? But when I go, I'm, super anal about, everything is boiled and everything is super clean. And thank God that's, the only way, I survived the whole thing. I don't know. How did you feel? How different was the crowd for you, the Middle East crowd versus the India crowd, per se? What was the difference you felt?
Well, I've never actually played for Middle Easterners when I was in the Middle East. It's always expats or troops.
That's right.
Like when you played in the Persian Gulf at hotels with Whose Line, we'd be playing for a group of yabby British guys who thought it was fun to go to bars. In those days in the Gulf, I'm not kidding, in the 90s, bars where there was a dwarf mascot at the door. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So we refused to even go to their bars or hang out with them after. We went in a cab to where the cab drivers eat at night. So we were the only non-believers there.
Oh,
we washed our hands and we had our tandoori and our goat.
From America.
Yeah. And we were the drunk British and American people. And we avoided the other British people as much as we could because they were the plane ride to Dubai in 1994 was as rowdy and loud and drunken as anything I've ever seen in my life. A plane ride from London to Dubai. People were throwing things because they knew us from Whose Line.
Yeah.
People were throwing stuff at us, screaming, shit-faced drunk. And they have to live there, the people who work in the Gulf, for tax reasons, the people from the States and Britain, 330 days a year, something like that. They have to physically be there. They can come back for a month. And then if you wish to maintain the tax status whereby you don't have to pay at home. So when they go and come back, they're insane. You know, the Indian crowds were lovely. People brought their children. There was every age represented. We had a lot of rich tech asshole types up front who were drunk and privileged. So you got to see another culture do that. The social media in India is ridiculous. You know, everyone is on everything. Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. We had to do a social media press conference for our comedy show that went all day.
Whoa.
Yeah. And we took selfies with everyone after. And so after the show was a good hour of taking selfies.
Yeah.
With people. And they had bodyguards for us.
Yeah.
And I don't mean one bodyguard. We're not even famous comedians. And I had six of the biggest, baddest dudes you've ever seen with guns walking me in and out of the venue.
And
Jeff Davis took a picture of it. And I'm going like this, like I'm a star. And none of them spoke a word of English. They spoke Taguru in that province.
Yeah, they speak Telugu.
Telugu, thank you. Forgive me. Telugu. And our promoters were Muslim, but they were promoting for this booze concern. It was a booze generated. Yeah, and I said to him, how do they know who I am or why they're supposed to do this? And he goes, I just tell them, see that sahib? Follow him. Don't let anyone get near him.
That's right. Sahib. So, that's it.
There was that amazing scariness of having that because I was like, I don't need a bodyguard. This is a comedy show. And then, oh, yeah, you do. Because if you get kidnapped or anybody fucks with you, then, you know, we're promoting this thing.
Right.
And then so
it
was an education. Let me put it that way. And it made me very to see people under the age of five working was
That's right. I mean, I honestly, anytime I start bitching or moaning about my life and whenever, you know, I haven't been since 2006, but I see these, I remember seeing this, this kid no more than maybe 10, 11 years old. And he was helping his dad. His dad was a mechanic and they were literally sleeping on the sidewalk under a tree and they were taking a nap before they went back to work. And I was just, Yeah, I'm like never gonna complain about my life again. Like that's, I'm fine. Like I'm fine.
Right. Well, you've gone through so much, Mona. You're so strong. But that's what kills me when I see these white people complaining they can't go to the beach. It's like, we're only asking you to do this for a few months. Right. And then you can go to the beach.
Or you don't die. That's what
I'm asking
you to do. You don't die. It's for you.
Unbelievable.
How long do you think it's going to take? I mean, did you hear about the governor pushing back, the Orange County governor Governor Newsom came out and said that the Orange County beaches should be closed, and the Orange County folks are coming back and pushing back and saying, no, the beaches should be open.
Yeah, I saw it. And now I saw today a photo, and I hope it's true, from Twitter, where they're really enforcing it. Huntington Beach is absolutely closed now. They're not giving out tickets, and they're not arresting anyone because it's all white people. But they've closed the beach and they're not letting people on. Although I saw a picture of Central Park today and no one's wearing a mask. Everyone's out in the sun, people running around. This is going to go on forever if people don't quarantine.
I mean,
tracing, quarantine, and testing are the only things that get you through a pandemic.
That's correct.
It's just ancient history. You can read about pandemics in every culture through the history of time.
Okay.
The ones that came from Asia in the Middle Ages, the ones in ancient Greece, the ones in Rome, the ones in London in the 1600s. I mean, how many times do we have to hear that bloody, who was the apple fell on its head, Newton, that Newton wrote his theory of relativity during the plague that year? And it's like, well, good for him. I'm having trouble just getting up in the morning.
Exactly. I'm not productive, and I'm just like, I can't get past this weed. I just want to keep smoking this weed.
Right?
So, Newton's out there, like, changing the world. No, that's pretty amazing. So now, do you have any live shows that are still going to go on? Are they like towards the end of the year? Nothing, huh?
We had 75 dates booked in my group. I'm in a Who's Line group with Ryan Stiles, Joel Murray, who's from Mad Men and Dharma Greg, Jeff Davis, and our musical director, Bob, and our tour director, Morgan. And we've worked together. Joel's the new guy. He's been in the group 7 years. Jeff was the new guy before that. He's been in the group 18 years. Wow. Ryan and I have been on the road for 20 years together. And the last couple of years, our business was booming. We did 100 dates last year.
Wow.
So I'm on the road a couple hundred days a year between doing stand-up and
that.
And it's all gone.
Wow. That's
no further notice. You know what I mean? Keep rescheduling the dates.
Mm-hmm.
And the agents who are being as nice as they can.
Yeah.
I mean, I got a letter the other day. I was supposed to do a date in St. Louis at a theater. And, you know, the place where it is, the university, is like, we don't know when we're opening again. So we just want to let you know that this date is not, you know.
Right.
We're under the very real, you and I, the business we're in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a group of people in a room, and that might not happen for a while.
That's right. I mean, they're barely, like, they're talking about how businesses are going to be open in different stages. They're talking about if a restaurant has, like, you know, it's with 20%, 25% capacity, 6 feet distant, people have to, you know, wear masks. I mean, we're living in a whole new world now. You know, we used to make fun of Michael Jackson when he used to come out with a mask and call
him,
and now everybody's a freak, you know?
Yep.
Freak is the new normal. Like that.
I won't go out in front of my house without a mask.
Yeah.
I think it's rude. I think it's, if I'm going out to like water the lawn or pick up the garbage or whatever, I still wear a mask. And I see dudes, this is Los Angeles, you know.
Yeah.
I see dudes with no shirt and no mask skating, riding a skateboard, running into people, jogging. I mean, I don't know what it takes to get through to people, but it's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like, and this whole thing of what they were in Huntington Beach protesting, was it last week or the week before, where, you know, this lockdown was being equal to slavery. I was like slap in the face of the, you know, descendants of slaves. Like what a slap in the face. Like if you even had like Tommy Lauren is coming out and saying that it's slavery. I'm like, Tommy, have you worked on a fucking cotton field? Have your children been taken away?
Nope.
Have you been beaten every single day because, you know, of the color of your skin? Then shut up. Like, you know nothing about slavery. I know nothing about slavery, but I know enough to not make an ignorant comment like that.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't know anything. She's a clown, you know, for the right. Like, they want to have those types, the, what are they, who called her? Bump stock Barbie, you know, like they love having those like Aryan princess types come out and talk about freedom when it's exactly the opposite of what. Also, I have too much respect for like the people who work in hospitals. I've had a lot of operations in the last, you know, couple of years. I hurt my thumb and I've had it. Yeah. And so all the people that work in these hospitals in Southern California are Black, are women, are from Asia or from subcontinent.
A lot of Filipino nurses.
All the Filipino nurses, all the Latins. And they couldn't be nicer. They couldn't have been sweeter to me. They couldn't have been more caring. Yeah. And you're going to fuck them over by going to the beach. That's you're going to make their life worse.
That's right.
By going to the beach.
That's right.
It's infuriating.
Yeah.
And it's so disrespectful of everyone who's doing real work. My wife said it the other day. She said, I'm astonished the garbage still gets picked up every week promptly. What's in it for them? You know what I mean? They have to do it. It's their gig. They don't get any money. Whereas, you know, you and I have some privilege, but what's been taken away from us as live performers is if you make your money as a live performer, man, you know, which is why we're doing these things and trying to support each other.
That's right. That's right.
There's a thing called Comedy Gives Back that Zoe Friedman's doing with a bunch of people. That's a charity. Mike Birbiglia is doing his thing for the club workers where you can help pay for them because they've all lost their jobs. All the people that we work with, the comedy store.
That's right.
How many servers and cooks, bartenders, and janitors are there?
That's right.
Three dozen?
That's right.
You know, I mean, every gig I play, every theater we play, we're keeping a whole support system of hotels, which means cooks, housekeepers, janitors, hotel staff, flight attendants, the people who maintain the planes. We're talking about a zillion people here. That's what the performing industry is.
Yeah.
And all of us are kind of fucked because our gig is not, it's necessary because poetry is always necessary.
I mean, look at what people are turning to in quarantine. Arts.
Yeah.
Imagine if there was no Netflix, no comedy, that was nothing. Like, what would be like, just his brains out. Are you kidding me? If it wasn't art.
People always point out, conservatives are always trying to cut funding to the arts. And then when something like this happens, all the arts is all you have. Then you realize how dependent you are on music that, people of color made and and invented for you.
Correct.
So you can keep body and soul together.
Out of Beyonce. Like, I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to live without Beyonce. Like, are you kidding me right now?
Well, they're always saying arts aren't critical, but when the time gets tough, baby, poetry is the only thing that gets you through. Being able to laugh. You know, I was lucky enough that I had 300 people watching that show last night that we did for stand-up. Yeah. And obviously, they're captive audience.
Yeah.
But also, we're talking about who has any discretionary money now? You know what I mean? We're all worried about, like, 3 months from now.
That's
so
right.
It's very emotional to think about how devoted comedy fans are. And how lovely they can be, you know?
Yep. My brother is my third oldest brother. All my brothers do very well for themselves. They're all, you know, tech and business guys. They all work for themselves. And my third oldest brother does very well for himself. And he called me up and he was like, hey, you know, if you want to just come and stay with me in Dallas, like, no problem. You know, he's not worried about money. He's fine. He's like, you know, he's like, so it's going to take another like 3-6 months. So big deal. I'm like, no big deal to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have all this money stashed away that you made, and you're a really smart guy, and you made all this money. I was like, that 3 to 6 months to your sister means the world. I was like, to me, like, that's like, it's almost like semi-death. Like, what am I going to do? He's like, yeah, but you have me. And I'm like, but that's not the point. I was like, there are millions of people who don't have people like you in their life. What about those people? You know? And he was like, you know, that's so interesting. He's like, if I didn't have a sister who was an artist, I would never really process that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a form of privilege too. That's a form of, I guess in a way, like brown privilege, like you make all this money. I have like uber wealthy Pakistani friends who sold their companies for $300 million and $600 million and $1 billion. You know, they've made a shit ton of money. To them, they don't even think about something like that. They're like, but to us, like, we're fine. And I'm just like, nah, you don't understand. But artists like us, like, you know, like just like you said, you know, the bartenders and the servers and the cooks, like, how are they going to survive? Nobody has like, you know, $30,000-$40,000 stashed away. Like, yeah. We don't have that kind of like money yet. Like, I don't have Netflix money yet. Like, I'm trying to get that.
Right.
I'm trying to get that Comedy Central money. I don't have that money yet. I'm trying to work on it. So. Do you have any online shows coming up this week or next week?
Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, they're on my website, and they're on Eventbrite. I'm doing the Nowhere Comedy Club with Mr. Glebe. On the 12th, we're going to do something. We're going to improvise.
Okay, awesome.
And then on the 30th, I'll be doing my podcast, The Smartest Man in the World, on the same show from the Nowhere Comedy Club. And I think I'm going to try to start doing at least one a month live, because a big part of my business was taking the podcast everywhere. We blew out a date in Brooklyn and we blew out a date in London. That's in the last few weeks. I was supposed to be in, as we all were, I was supposed to be in Brooklyn. Then I was going to go to London with my wife, do the podcast in London. And I can't. So I think the people that like it, the 30th is the date that we'll be doing it here. I've also been able to do, I'm on this thing called Cameo, where you're basically a party clown and you do a little video for people and they pay you money to do it.
Okay.
And they had a benefit a couple weeks ago, which was really nice.
Yeah.
And, the money that we made for a certain period, we could donate to a charity. So I donated mine to the Restaurant Workers Fund because they're, as we were talking about. And then Liz Winstead is a friend of mine who's a vociferous and giant crusader for women's access to abortion. They had a benefit a couple of days ago that was like an all-day affair and got a bunch of people to do it. And they raised $120,000 for independent clinics, because independent clinics are sometimes the only recourse women have, especially in rural places. It's not just a matter of abortion. It's a matter of every element of women's health, pap smears, testing. Prophylactics, toothbrushes for their children. It really is not bad. So I've been trying to stay on top of that and be, you know, try to raise money for charity and give money to charity, try to amplify that on social media and stuff. Rich people really don't think about anybody. They only think about that the world is their servant and it's waiting to jump when they say so. To them, this is, they put the world's on pause. But for a lot of us, as you say, the world's not on pause. The world is receding away from us.
That's correct.
Until we can figure out a new way.
That's right.
Bring
That's
some bread into the house.
I mean, we're just living in this. I feel like multiplexes are going to disappear after this. I mean, I don't know if you heard about this movie Trolls, which is for kids. They released it online and they did $100 million. They did over $100 million. And that's just really going to change the business structure of how movies are released. You know, they're like, hey, why do I have to spend all this money putting it up in multiplexes and around the world? I can just release it online and people can just pay $20 and the entire family gets to watch it, while a family of four has to drop between $150 to $200 to go park in a multiplex, buy the tickets, buy the popcorn. Why? You just give it $20 and you can just do it right from home. I wonder, do you think that's going to somehow change the business model in stand-up comedy also, and how that's going to affect us, you think?
I do, Mona. I don't know what the outcome will be. I think that the stronger places that have money that are owned by giant corporations will probably make it. And that the ones that don't are going to be a little more precarious. Right. I can think of some club owners that I know that literally own their club personally.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's going to happen to them. Yeah. I think there's not a lot of unemployment insurance for performers. Or any, and the structure of performing, I think, is going to be changed. What I worry about is that so many venues are going to close.
Yeah. But then
the good part that I try not to freak out over is when things do reopen and safely, there'll be a giant market for us.
Yeah,
my wife keeps saying it's not like you're going to lose popularity while this is going on, because there's no show business now other than recycled show business and whatever you and I are making. It's an opportunity for us, like podcasting was 10 years ago, to, as Mark Maron once said to me, to wrest the means of production. Podcasting proved to comedians that we don't need a TV producer. We don't need a gatekeeper. We don't know. We don't need a guy named Brad telling you whether you're funny or not. And whether, you know, oh, Mona, we already have a you know, a Pakistani comic.
That's right.
That's gone now, because you don't podcasting. If we could do it on our own with a microphone.
That's correct. I mean, that's interesting you said that, because I was coming up. I've been trying to put out like these videos and stuff. I just did this video about, you know, remember that Dolly Parton song, Jolene? So I did Chlorine, and I did a whole thing about how chlorine, it's like, don't drink this crap, you will die before COVID gets to you. So I've been like working on that, and I was just like, man, you know, whenever I go out to audition, like, what are like the standard auditions that Middle Eastern and South Asian girls always go out for? And it's always like the terrorist mom, or the terrorist wife, or the scared, you know, or the scared woman. There's always like these stereotypical, and I wanted to do a whole sketch on, I wanted to do a whole video on it. Like, these are, that's it. This is how like casting sees us. We're just like these, like very like, you know, just everything is very linear. There's no like dimensions to us. We're just very linear. We're just like scared women all the time. And I was just like, only if they heard my profanity laced mouth. Like, if they only heard what a freaking potty mouth I am. By the way, that show that we did last Sunday was amazing. That was a fantastic show.
It was good fun. They're doing a good thing there. They sprang into action, and so I appreciate that, because, you know, I think we're all trying to reach out to each other now and include each other a little more, which I'd really like to see. Them offering something where you can actually make money.
Yes.
So bloody important. And like I said, the people that give money, like that, when we did it last Sunday, and that one woman gave $400.
That's right.
I don't know who has $400 to just throw. You know what I mean? That's a lot of bread. I think that part's beautiful. And I think carry on doing that and smash all that shit down, because, you know, I watch Homeland. I see what women from the subcontinent in the Middle East get to play. Yeah. Either they're toting a gun, or they're
gun, or they always have an accent. It's like, please don't take my son. Like, oh man, come on.
Well, you know, Oma Jalili is a friend of mine, right? And Oma Jalili is a comic from Britain, and he's
great. I mean, this is great.
He's Persian, his family's from Iran, and he plays almost only Arab terrorists. Tour guides, Egyptians. It depends on how much money you'll have. You know, like, all of a sudden, it's hilarious. And he's just, this is what he gets to play. Like,
right. These are all the roles. These are all the roles that they give us. Or there's Mindy Kaling, who's like a Valley Girl. You know, she's a complete Valley Girl. And I love her to pieces. She's freaking great. But there's always like these roles that were always just like, you're just this, or you're just that, and you're like, all right, I guess that's gonna eventually change too.
How long have black women had to play prostitutes, maids, and all Latins are gardeners, is it, or gangsters, you know? You don't know, Latin lawyers,
cartels, or yeah. Or the Latina is just like this hot, sexy Latina, and she can't be anything else. Like, just very singular, just one-dimensional characters. Just very one-dimensional.
Latin women are overheated, apparently, for papi. And the Super Bowl, which is not something that I love.
Yeah.
My wife and I watched the halftime show this year because it was J-Lo and Shakira for 20 minutes, and they were killing it, you know. And that one and the Madonna
one that strip pole,
unbelievable. And the Madonna one from a few years ago, where she had Cardi B. Who else did she have on? She had a couple African-American singers out with her. The Madonna one I loved. Like,
yes.
I mean, you know, I love Aerosmith as much as the next white guy. But yeah. I do like to see her.
Yeah. And I'm not a white guy, and I love Aerosmith.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when they bring someone out like Prince or whatever.
Yes.
My favorite one was years ago. I was playing with Drew in Las Vegas. We used to do improv at the MGM Grand during Super Bowl weekend, which is really vile because every hillbilly is in Vegas and putting beers in the, you know, the wells of the slot machines and walking around with their caps on. And so I would try to hide a lot. I was in a restaurant when the Super Bowl was on. Normally I would go to the spa. I'd have a big gay spa day. I'd take my wife with me and we'd go to the spa, separate spas, and then meet up and have dinner after.
Yeah.
And get a table anywhere because the Super Bowl.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you know, unless it was a bar with a TV. And I was at this steakhouse or something at the MGM. And Paul McCartney was on. And he was hammering through, you know, old Beatles songs and whatnot. And I remember turning and there was a black guy at the bar. And the black guy turned and went, who is this? And I thought, wow. Also thinks that everybody is a white guy named Rick. And Shakira and J-Lo was so good. You know, when Beyonce did it. And how about the year that they had, was it Bruno Mars?
Chris Martin.
Yeah, Chris Martin. And then they had and Beyonce, was it?
Not three of them, yeah.
Bruno Mars and Beyonce wore these astonishing outfits.
Yes. She paid homage to Michael Jackson, remember her outfit? Yeah.
And then the hair and everything. And then Chris Martin came out in a fucking t-shirt. And someone wrote a meme the next day with the three of them. And it said, your Uber driver's here. And I think that's another part of...
That's funny.
I should probably let you go. But another part of this pandemic to me is a lot of people are waiting...
Oh, Greg, I was actually feeling, okay, we're going to start wrapping it up because I've taken too much of Greg's time.
No, I do have to go smoke pot. So
the important stuff, come on, matters.
A lot of people that want to be slobs all the time. Yeah. And LA is the place where, like, even before this, you know, you see people wearing flip-flops and jeans and that's all the effort they're going to make. And I and I'm a big priss.
Yeah.
My wife's very elegant, and she's taught me to, you know, look like something, dress like something, be something, smell, shave.
Yeah.
So I'm still doing it, and it's keep helping me stay together. A lot of people, I think this is their big opportunity to never wear shoes again, and that's what they've always wanted. Where I can't wait to buy a new pair of shoes when this is over.
A song for that. No shoes, no shirt, no problem. I know that because I'm a big country music fan. That's why I love country music. Greg, where can we find you?
Where? I'm on Twitter at Greg Proops. I'm on Instagram at Proopdog. I think I said GregProops.com. I'll post those dates on my website. And then I have a podcast that comes out generally every Monday, sometimes on Tuesday, that called The Smartest Man in the World. I do it with my wife, Jennifer, from here in the fortress.
Love it.
Dude. And that's what's happening, baby.
Your fabulous jacket's great.
Last question, sorry for me. Tell me about some of the other guests you have on your show. You said you often have people from foreign countries.
Yeah, so I have the UN ambassador of Pakistan who's going to be coming on as a guest. Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah, so I got hired by this woman in New York last year to come out this and MC this massive event in Long Island. And the UN ambassador was invited to the event. And I didn't know that. I learned about it later. And I was MCing the whole event. And then after the event, she walks up to me and she didn't want to talk to anybody except me. And she was just like, I am a fan. Where do I find you? I need you to come to the consulate and have tea with me. And I was like,
really?
Yeah. And I was like, okay. She's like, take my phone number. And I was like, okay. And I took her mobile number. And we just kind of became friends, if you want to call that. And then I messaged her and I was like, hey, would you like to come and be a guest? And she was like, yeah, I'd love to. So that's how I ended up getting her. But Margaret Cho's been a guest. Mm-hmm. Nagaban, who was a star of the movie Aladdin, he plays the Sultan on it. He was on it. So yeah, I've just been trying to basically globalize the podcast and just bring all these incredible people that, you know, you don't regularly get to see them and meet them, and trying to get this kind of personal perspective where it's not just talking about careers, but it's also just getting to know them personally and what their, you know, your humanity is like. So that's what I'm trying to do.
That's beautiful. And I love that you're...
Thank you.
My problem with comedy is always that it's so white guy oriented that it kept friends of mine away from wanting to even be around stand-up for whole lifetimes. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Who wants to see three guys tell knob gags in a row, which is what comedy was when I started, you know, in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And so I think it's fantastic.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on and, you know, being a guest today. It just really means the world to me, and somebody who I've watched and admired for so long. So thank you so much.
Oh, very kind of you. You should definitely do Glebe's club.
Yeah, I'm going to hit him up and I'm going to ask him. Hopefully he liked my traumatic jokes that I did towards the end of my set last
night. I enjoyed it. I think the best part is watching the paradigm of show business crumble and all of us have to be more personal with each other.
Yeah, that's right.
The thing
right.
I found about podcasting is it took away the veneer that stand-up had of keeping a little bit of distance and allowed me to talk to every single person in the audience, which I would do before the show. And that's something I'm going to miss quite a lot. I actually shook hands with everybody who came to my podcast and talked to them.
Yeah.
You know, and had tried to have an interaction with everyone to make it a different comedy playing field. Yeah. Stand-up is contentious because some people don't know why they're there. You really don't. They've been dragged there, and then they don't like you, and then they feel they have the right to complain about your comedy, even though you wouldn't do that with any other thing you saw. That's you would right. never just go see music and not know where you're going. You wouldn't go to a movie that you didn't know what it is.
That's right.
And you wouldn't yell at the screen, change movie into a movie I like. But that's people feel free to yell at us.
That's right. Because after I did that event that I just told you about in New York, where I met the UN ambassador, this guy saw me and he was like, I need you to come out and perform in front of like 3,000 people at this event in Queens. And I was like, okay. So then he invited me, and these are all like Pakistani people.
Yeah.
And it was to celebrate Eid. Eid is like our Christmas. It's like the end of Ramadan. So I went and I was performing. And the craziest thing is, Greg, the people who were cheering me on were all guys. And the people who were trying to get me off stage were the women.
Really?
Yes. The patriarchy, the toxic patriarchy is so deeply internalized. Yeah. That they couldn't stand seeing a woman from their part of the world get up there and have the balls to talk about the things that they would never talk about. And the guys were loving it and supporting me. The women were like so against it.
That's
like, isn't it crazy?
Yes.
It was crazy. But I had a great time. I didn't care. I kind of went a little Bill Burrish on them where I was just like going in. I was just going in. I was like, fuck you. Who fucking cared? Do you think I'm going to come back and perform for you? Fuck off. I don't fucking care.
Yeah.
I was just going in. But it was a lot of fun. And I think, comedy has like single-handedly saved my life. So I owe a lot to stand-up. So, you know, it's been amazing. But Greg, I adore you. I definitely hope to meet you someday very soon.
Right. We'll meet in person one day. Yeah. Thanks for having me on the show, Mona.
So much. Thank you, Greg. Take care. Have a great Sunday.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thanks. All right. That was the amazing Greg Proofs. I am so grateful for him to come and be our guest today. Please don't forget to subscribe to our channel on YouTube at Minority Reports with a Z. You can follow us on Instagram at Mona Shake Presents. And also follow us on Twitter at M Reports with a Z. I will see you guys next time. Thank you very much for tuning in.